Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Isaac Shapiro, the author of Edoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavenah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking lately about how important religion really is in our society. I'd like to say it matters very much, since that's what I do and care about, but in truth, I've lived my professional life as a rabbi and cantor in an American environment in which the value of religion is questioned regularly. Where it was once central to the life of nearly every person in our society, by the 21st century it's become for so many in contemporary America an ancillary part of life, not central. You do not need to be an atheist to realize that religious experience is not very high on the list of priorities for most of your contemporaries. Yes, many people continue to belong to and occasionally attend religious institutions, but for almost every one of them, it's far from the center of their lives, and that's demonstrated regularly by a singular lack of commitment. And for those who are younger than I am, more people every day, of course, there's an even greater loss of connection to religion. The millennial generation doesn't commit to institutions, we're told, but realistically, neither did my own end of the baby boomer group, at least not to organized religious institutions, and certainly not as readily as earlier generations did. You see, holy places aren't much of an investment. There do not seem to be any truly sustainable business plans that work long-term for temples or churches. There are very few metrics that measure the value added by prayer in a sacred space or pilgrimage to a famous holy site. There are no analytic analyses that prove that incorporating religion into your life helps you develop exponentially, like, you know, an internet startup does. What religion does do is harder to measure. It gives a sense of purpose and meaning in life. It allows you to connect to something greater than yourself. It helps find community and human connection with people motivated to try to do good in our society. It provides opportunities for consolation at times of grief, celebration at times of joy, support and compassion in illness. Religion can even sometimes give you answers when you are lost or confused. It's hard to put a price tag on what we gain from being religious or from having a religious community in our lives. But there is little doubt that these hard-to-quantify gains are incredibly important. And very likely, just what our troubled society needs most right now. On a related theme, I have to share with you that we here at Two Jewish lost one of our most devoted and dedicated listeners last week. It was an incredible woman named Gladys Handfling, a remarkable person, strong, smart, principled, dedicated, and incredibly devoted to Judaism and to Two Jewish. I traveled to Seattle, Washington to officiate at Gladys's funeral there. Her children and grandchildren live there, and in her honor, it was sunny and beautiful. Gladys loved Judaism, and she loved this show, never missing a live broadcast. She refused to go to meetings or classes that overlapped with Two Jewish, and she would not answer her phone when the show was on the air. She would often email me or call after Two Jewish to congratulate us on a good guest interview or an interesting segment. Always knew that no matter who else was out there, Gladys was listening. I know somewhere up there she still is. Gladys, in your memory, this Two Jewish Show is dedicated to you. We're approaching the season of Passover now, with the beginning of the Hebrew month of Nisan this coming Saturday. The start of the springtime month on the Jewish calendar intensifies a period when we explore the concept of freedom, its extraordinary importance and meaning. And so to play us in this morning, as part of our pre-Passover preview of music for Pesach, here's Yehoram Gaon's version of Ken Supiense, Who Knows One, a Sephardic setting of Echad Miyodea from the Seder for the first two nights of the upcoming Festival of Freedom.
Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualo es el uno, cualo es el uno. Uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualos son los dos, cualos son los dos. Dos Moshe y Aaron, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualos son los tres, cualos son los tres. Tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualos son los cuatro, cualos son los cuatro. Cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualos son los cinco, cualos son los cinco. Cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualos son los sesh, cualos son los sesh. Sesh días de la semana, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos de Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cualos son los siete, cualos son los siete. Siete días con el Shabbat, seis días de la semana, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo.
That was Yehoram Gaon's Sephardic version of Who Knows One for the Passover Seder, coming March 30th and 31st to a Jewish home near you. Our guest this morning, Isaac Shapiro, has a most unusual story to tell. He was a Jew who grew up in Japan before and during World War II. Find out what that extraordinary experience was like when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. His name is Ike Shapiro. He has a new book, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan, called Edoko. It is a fascinating part of the entire story of World War II and, of course, the Shoah that I don't think anybody knows much about. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. And my name is Isaac. I was named after my grandfather, Isaac Shapiro. Ike was a nickname given to me by the American occupying forces when they came to Japan.
So how did you come to Japan? You know, Japan, while a fascinating ancient culture, has never had much of a Jewish community. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Well, actually, the Jewish community was started in Kobe in the late 20th century. By the time my parents got to Japan in 1928, there was a synagogue in Kobe, which was a big port, and where the Jewish community grew. My parents settled in Tokyo in 1928, and I was born in Tokyo in 1931, hence the title of my book, Edoko, which means literally child of Edo, E-D-O, and Edo was the name of Tokyo before it was converted to Tokyo in 1868. By the time I was born, it was called Tokyo, and so I named my book Child of Edo, as I was born there.
How did your parents come to Japan in the first place? Can you tell us?
I will tell you. My parents were both musicians. My father was a cellist, my mother a pianist. They were both born in Russia. My father was born in Saratov, which was outside the so-called Pale of Settlement, but his father was a banker, and he was allowed to live outside the Pale of Settlement. My mother was born in Odessa, in what is now Ukraine.
Right.
And she came from Polish and Ukrainian ancestry. They met in Berlin when my mother was a student there at the Conservatory of Music. In the meantime, my mother's family had moved to China because of the pogroms, anti-Jewish pogroms in Odessa. So my mother came to China as a baby of 4 months and grew up there. And then in 1925, she went to Berlin to study music, because Berlin was then the musical capital of the world. And she met my father there, who had arrived in Germany after the Russian Revolution and had been playing cello in orchestras and nightclubs. And they were introduced by a cousin of my father's, Maxim Shapiro, a pianist. And they fell in love, and in December 1925, the chief rabbi of Berlin married them. And they proceeded initially to Paris, where my father's parents were living after the revolution. And then my father got the idea of going to Palestine. He'd been bitten by the bug of Zionism. And they went to Palestine in 1926, spent 2 years there, during which my father played with the Tel Aviv Symphony. But when my mother was pregnant with her third child, she'd had twins in 1926, she said she didn't want to stay in Palestine. Times were very difficult, and she wanted to move back to China to be with her father. So in 1928, they moved first to Harbin, China, and stayed with my maternal grandfather. And then my father was invited to move to Tokyo and play with the orchestra there and be a professor at the what was then called the Toyo School of Music, where there were several refugees teaching. And that's how they came to Japan in 1928 or 29. Forgotten which, and I was my mother's third child was born in China in Harbin, and I was son number four, and I was born in Tokyo.
It's a fascinating journey. We will follow it much more extensively with Isaac Shapiro when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Yeah. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week through the lens of a film about Northern Italy and Italy in general, the Italian Jewish community. We both had experience. We've talked about it on Too Jewish before, but the Italian Jewish community has changed in part because of a wash of refugees and immigrants that have come. Let's talk about what makes somebody an Italian Jew.
Right. Well, the majority of the Italian Jewish community isn't terribly Italian, or they are now Italian, but their roots in Italy don't go very deep. What used to be the case historically throughout the Middle Ages and before Italy became a modern nation state in the late 1800s was that all the small towns in the north had significant old Jewish communities.
And not just the north. I mean, the Roman Jewish community goes back to Maccabean.
Yeah, but Rome isn't a small town. I'm talking about all the little towns like Ferrara, Ravenna, Verona, Siena, all those places.
Right.
And obviously Florence and Venice are not small towns either, but they had historic Jewish communities. Venice is, in fact, the place where the term ghetto was invented. And Jews played a large role in the history of these cities, which were once city-states, and some of them had their own mercantile empires. Certainly Genoa and Venice had mercantile trading empires, which local Jews helped to build and to sustain. Most of those Jewish communities are either completely gone or they're very small right now. There are remnants left. There might be like one active synagogue in many of those towns, but it's small. The two communities that are large and very active with schools and the whole range of normal Jewish communal services are Rome and Milano. And they are very different in character in the sense that Milano was for centuries an Austrian city. So it was more in line with the marching orders of Hitler and deported more Jews in after the war. Only a very tiny percentage of Milanese Jews survived.
Right.
Rome was different. Rome had a tradition of Jews being protected by the Pope, and Romans are Southerners and defiant of law and order, and they didn't like the Nazis at all. So a fairly large percentage of the Jewish community of Rome did survive. And by fairly large, I mean more than 1 or 2%, not 75%, not a majority, but a lot came back, rebuilt the community.
It's one of the highest percentages of any country in Europe, actually, in Italy, primarily because so many of the Roman Jewish community did survive.
Right. And so what then happened is after the Israeli War of Independence in 1948, and as Israel became established as a state, there was, for a variety of reasons, a huge exodus of Jews from Muslim countries. And Libya had been an Italian colony. Most of the Libyan Jews ended up in Rome. Some in Israel, some in other places, but a lot in Rome. Interestingly, in Milano, a lot of Egyptian Jews and Persian Jews ended up settling. A lot of them went into the Oriental carpet business, but probably the majority of the Jewish community in Milano originates in those three countries, Iran, Egypt, and Libya. Whereas in Rome, the majority is probably of Italian origin, and a significant percentage is also of Libyan origin.
Fascinating. You know, the Jewish world is not static, definitely dynamic.
Not at all.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for a recurring, inscrutably irregular feature of Too Jewish, Wisdom from Zen Judaism. Now No eggs and no cream, just syrup, seltzer, and milk. Zen of the egg cream. Today I am a man. Tomorrow I return to the seventh grade. And a final haiku for Jews. The sparrow brings home too many worms for her young. Force yourself, she chirps. That was Eternal Wisdom from Zen Judaism, koans of Haikus for Jews. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Dinachi, who are here as part of this incredible Shnat Sherut, the Year of Service program, which kept them away from Israel for many months, and they just came back recently. We talked last week about the experience overall, but what do you see differently now that you've come back? Tell us a little bit about what it means to go home and then come back and then see the work that you're doing here in America on behalf of Israel.
So I think coming back to Israel let us have a different perspective on our year here, because you kind of zone out and you look at it from a different angle. So you learn to appreciate what you have here. And I think just a basic example is that I didn't really appreciate all the wonderful nature Tucson has to offer that I don't get to see in Israel all the time. And one of the most important things for me since I got back was like, I want to go see the Desert Museum already. I'm here for 5 months.
And you've never been.
So we went there like a week after we got back. And it was just an amazing experience to really see the nature in Tucson and the wildlife that we saw there. It was incredible.
So part of it is just realizing what you're not taking advantage of in the place where you are most of the time now.
Yes. Yeah, and also like I never really understood that I'm like in a different country with like different culture and different people, because after like a little while you kind of get used to it. But then I came home and I felt like, oh, this is my home, like this is where I'm used to. And then coming back here feels all new and like everything's exciting, and suddenly it really hit me that I'm not like in my own country, and it's in the most beautiful way. Like everything, I feel the need to like do everything and like not waste the time I have here, you know?
To take advantage of every moment.
Yes.
If you can. When you tell your friends back home and your family about your experience, what do you say is the most enriching, valuable part of what you're doing?
I think probably the people, like the relationships we've come to build here with people, which is kind of sad because we're leaving soon, but I hope to still...
Not so soon. You have a little time.
It's like 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
I truly think that that's like the most amazing part to me. Like some of my students that I really feel like I've influenced on and like really, really kind of
connected
educated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, taught them about Israel.
Mm-hmm. And now our adult program and our host families, it's bonds that you can't make in any other way. So it's really cool.
Tamir, what do you tell people has been the most valuable part of your experience?
So I think that, first of all, I think I grew as a person. And I tell people that I think that working in an environment where I have to, like, change hats, it's an expression in Hebrew where you have to, like, be different.
It's an expression in English, too.
It is. Awesome. Yeah. So you kind of have to change
hats.
Maybe
we'll say change kippot, you know, you're changing your yarmulke.
Exactly. So I have to change my yarmulke every day. And I see people of all ages. And now that we're working on our newest adult program, then it's a totally new yarmulke. So we're really working on bringing ourselves in many different ways to different people in the community to create bridges and influences that will go deeper into the community.
Thank you. Great visit. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In honor of this week's Torah portion of Vayikra, which deals with the antiquated idea of animal sacrifice, long replaced by prayer and acts of charity in our tradition, our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from the great English author D.H. Lawrence, better known as a novelist, and it's on the subject of sacrifice. The old idea of sacrifice was this: The blood of the lower life must be shed for the feeding and strengthening of the handsome, fuller life. Oh, when the old world sacrificed a ram, it was to the gods who make us splendid, and it was for a feast of meat, for men and maids on a day of splendor, for the further splendor of men. It was the eating up of little lives, even doves, even small birds, into the dance and splendor of a bigger life. There is no such thing as sin. There is only life and anti-life. And sacrifice is the law which enacts that little lives must be eaten up into the dance and splendor of bigger lives with due reverence and acknowledgement. That was D.H. Lawrence's ironic poem, The Old Idea of Sacrifice. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Young Dr. Levine replaces the recently retired Dr. Cohen and is seeing his elderly patient, Mrs. Goldberg, for the first time. As he looks through Mrs. Goldberg's chart, he's startled to see that his predecessor prescribed birth control pills for her, and she's in the office specifically to get a renewal. Mrs. Goldberg, he says, you realize these are birth control pills? You're in your 80s. Why do you have them? Well, doctor, she says, they help me sleep better at night. Dr. Levine says, I can assure you there's nothing in birth control pills that could possibly help you sleep better at night. Mrs. Goldberg reaches over, pats young Dr. Levine on the knee and says, I get up very early each morning, grind up the pills, mix it in the orange juice, and give it to my 16-year-old granddaughter. Believe me, doctor, I sleep better at night. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, or Leviticus. Vayikra presents an entirely new challenge to the student of Torah. How do we find relevance in a portion reflecting religious practices that have been obsolete for nearly 2,000 years? The rites of the sacrificial cult that flourished in the days of the tabernacle in the wilderness and the temple in Jerusalem have been replaced for nearly two millennia by prayer, study, and a variety of other religious actions, mitzvot. Vayikra is a how-to book on korbanot, sacrifices. What do we make from a parsha replete with the ways to slaughter animals, the proper division of their bodies for placing on the altar and the fire, the different categories of sacrifices offered? One linguistic hint exists in the word for sacrifice itself, korban. The Hebrew root for sacrifice actually also means to bring near, karev, as in the Passover Haggadah text, karev yom, bring near the day. When we bring an animal to sacrifice, we are seeking to move close to God, not only to approach the power of divine acceptance, but also to come near to God in every way. We no longer choose to do this by actually giving up a valuable possession. Remember, livestock were like SUVs in their economic meaning for our ancestors, let alone by killing something, but we can still seek to find powerful and humbling ways to bring ourselves closer to God and to holiness. When we pray with sincerity, meditate with meaning, and reach out to find the flow of divine energy ever present in the world, we can discover the true essence of Vayikra. When we act to further justice in our world, ease the suffering of the impoverished, feed the hungry, house the homeless, we bring ourselves closer to God. If we act in these ways, we, like our ancestors of old, may find that our sacrifice of time, energy, and attention will bring us to holiness too. May this be God's will, but more importantly, may it be ours. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Isaac Shapiro, author of the new book Edoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan, will explain how Jews were treated in Japan during World War II and his own observations about the unique cross-cultural experiences he has had. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The ongoing corruption investigations into Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continue to develop. Nir Chaifetz, Prime Minister Netanyahu's spin doctor and confidant, will hand over recordings of Bibi Netanyahu and his wife Sara as part of a deal with police. He is turning state's evidence in a bribery case involving the Bezeq telecom giant and the Walla News site. Netanyahu was in the U.S. for the AIPAC conference at a meeting with President Trump last week and received the news while in Washington, D.C. at Blair House as a guest of the president. In return for testifying against Netanyahu, Chaifetz will not stand trial, face prison time, or be fined. While he testifies, he will be housed at an isolated installation. Chaifetz will also give information regarding other cases against the prime minister and his wife. Chaifetz is the third Netanyahu confidant to turn against the prime minister in these ongoing corruption cases. He is suspected of receiving bribes and obstructing justice as part of what is called Case 4000. He's also a key figure in Case Number 1270 and a secondary one in Case Number 2000. If you can't keep all these corruption cases straight, don't worry. Nobody can. Netanyahu aides said in response to the Chaifetz defection that when there is something, you don't need even one state's witness. When you don't have anything, even 1,000 state's witnesses won't help. Well, maybe. We will see. After a long wait, there's been progress on non-Orthodox prayer at the Kotel. Last week, Israel's attorney general told the country's Supreme Court that egalitarian Jewish prayer is a protected right in the Robinson's Arch area at the southern end of the Western Wall in the Old City of Jerusalem. The pronouncement means that the State of Israel officially considers the special area set aside for egalitarian prayer is now an official part of the Kotel, the holy site itself. Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit said in his submission to the Israeli Supreme Court, a government official not connected to the ultra-Orthodox dominated chief rabbinate, the Rabbanut, should oversee the site. That would protect non-Orthodox prayer rights at the Kotel. According to Mandelblit, making provisions for egalitarian prayer and freedom of access in the area designated for it at the wall falls under the law for protecting holy sites. The customs of the site at the Robinson's Arch area are for men and women to be able to pray together. I've led egalitarian B'nai Mitzvah there, by the way. That would not be well preserved by the chief rabbinate, which is completely opposed to any such kinds of prayer. The attorney general himself is a devout Orthodox Jew. Mandelblit is a follower of the Kabbalistic Ashlag school, but he has come down firmly now on the side of egalitarian prayer at the Kotel. Last month, construction finally began to upgrade the area set aside for egalitarian prayer at the wall. The work has a budget of $7 million, and it comes more than a year after a more comprehensive plan was approved and more than half a year after the plan was frozen. Back in June, the Israeli cabinet suspended a deal passed in 2016 as a result of extensive negotiations between the Reform and Conservative movements, the Women of the Wall, the Jewish Agency for Israel, and the Israeli government, all brokered by Natan Sharansky. The suspension came after the government's Haredi ultra-Orthodox coalition partners politically pressured Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to scrap the agreement. That was reported here on Too Jewish, of course. The plan would have included a common entrance to the Western Wall Plaza for all three sections and a public board overseeing egalitarian prayer that would include representatives of the non-Orthodox movements and the Women of the Wall. Israel's Supreme Court had a four-hour session on the issue of prayer rights for women at the Western Wall last month, indicated that physical upgrades to the section set aside for egalitarian prayer are key to satisfying the government's suspended agreements with the liberal Jewish groups. Let's hope, even pray, that this time the work will actually be completed. Men and women will be able to peacefully pray at an extended Robinson's Arch area near the Kotel, holiest place in the entire world for Jews. And finally, a grim tale to tell. I'm not sure what the worst part of this next story is. Is it the fact that an ice cream company in Russia named a new ice cream bar Poor Jews? The confection is sold in a blue and white package designed to look like the Israeli flag. That's pretty terrible. Worse might be the flavors, chocolate and prune with nuts on top. Chocolate and prune. Ugh. Lest you think this an inadvertent marketing faux pas, you should know that this same company, located 600 miles east of Moscow in the sticks in Tatarstan, previously had a chocolate ice cream bar named for Barack Obama and wrapped in a cover with a picture of an African boy on it, and named another one of its offerings with a slur against Ukrainians. Poor Jews ice cream. Oy. And you thought an American candy called crackheads was a bad idea. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish Art guests this morning. He's Isaac Shapiro, born in Tokyo in 1931, had an incredible journey during the war, came to the United States in 1946, and has been here ever since. His new book is called Edoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan. So you were born in, it was Tokyo, of course, by then.
Yes, it was Tokyo.
Ever since the Meiji Restoration, I think.
Correct.
And
1868.
Right. And you grew up in Japan. You were just a kid, but that was, of course, a time of increasing Japanese militarism, invasion of China. Did that affect you guys at all?
Not a great deal, except for the fact that when the Japanese occupied Manchuria, my grandfather, my mother's father, who was in the construction business, began to work for the Japanese occupation army, and in fact my mother and the four of us, her four sons, moved to Harbin in 1932 when I was barely a few months old, and my parents having separated, a separation that lasted for 5 years until they were reunited in 1936, and my mother and the four of us moved back to Japan and lived in Yokohama for most of the remaining time that I spent in Japan. And then in 1944, when the Japanese were at war with the United States and began to fortify the coastline, they moved us from Yokohama to Tokyo, the Japanese government did. And we lived in Tokyo during most of 1944 and 45 when the war ended. And I left home surreptitiously and went to meet the American armed forces in Tokyo Bay and got to know the Marine colonel who eventually brought me to the United States.
You were in school, was it in Britain during the beginning of the war?
It was a British school. It's called the International School of Japan, run by the Anglican Church in Yokohama, but it was closed after the war started because most of the teachers were British and went back home to join the British Armed Forces. We were then moved first to the American School in Japan, which continued to exist until Pearl Harbor, and we were eventually moved to the school called St. Joseph's College, which was a Marianist school, Catholic Society of Mary, and we spent most of the war at school at St. Joseph's, which again was closed in 1944 because they had to give up their quarters to the Japanese military.
Now, as a kid, you learned Hebrew. Of course, Japanese, living in Japan, and Russian, correct?
Yes, I spoke only Russian till I was 5 years old when I returned to Japan.
That you were in China before that, correct?
Yes, I spent years 1 to 5 in China. Born in Japan, then went back to China with my mother and brothers, and then returned to Japan in the summer of 36. And from then on, I stayed in Japan until I left for the United States in the summer of 1946. And I spoke no English, in fact, nothing other than Russian, and I knew a little Hebrew, not much. I could read it. And I learned English first at the British school and then at St. Joseph's, where I also learned French and Japanese.
So you, when Pearl Harbor took place, what was the, you know, you were what, 10 years old, almost 11?
I was almost 11, correct.
What was your experience of that?
Well, I describe it in the book. I learned about it walking on my way to school and seeing the Japanese neighbors all crowded around radios. And I said, what's going on? And they told me that Japan had attacked the United States and we were at war, or they were at war with the United States. And by the time we got to school, everybody was talking about nothing else but the beginning of the Second World War.
You lived in Japan throughout the whole of the Second World War then?
That's correct.
It must have been an extraordinary experience.
Well, it was, but the Japanese were very, I would say, correct and careful about classifying foreigners by nationality. And as I describe in my book, we were stateless,
right,
with no nationality, and the Japanese did not single us out because we were Jewish. We were of Russian origin, and my parents had no nationality, and so all our formal papers where your nationality was inquired would say stateless.
Now, you went to school, you were a kid growing up. When did the war begin to have an impact on Japan itself in your experience?
Well, when the bombings began in 1945, at first there were single B-29s, and then in late 44, the bombing started in earnest, particularly in 45 after the United States occupied Okinawa and Guam and were able to base their B-29s in large numbers, and we started to get extensive raids with multiple bombers. And in March of 1945, we had a terrible night raid in Tokyo. We were out putting out fires and so on. And it was after that that my parents sent my younger brother and me up to a village north of Tokyo, which was a summer resort, so we could get away from the bombing. And eventually they came up too. And the war ended with us all up in Karuizawa, this little village, in the middle of August, when the emperor spoke on the radio and announced the surrender of Japan.
We then
moved back to our house in Tokyo. But I had left, without telling my parents where I was going, it would be the 15th, 16th, 17th of August, and I went down to Yokohama where the American troops had already landed, and the headquarters was in the new Grand Hotel in Yokohama, and that's where I was picked up by American army officers first. Then, as I was on my way back home, I met some naval officers who took me to their ship in Yokosuka, and eventually I had the good fortune to meet a Marine colonel named Toby Munn from Arkansas. He was not Jewish. He had no children. And he took a liking to me. I became his driver and interpreter at the age of 14. And after several months, we bonded, and he said, I'd like to take you back to America with me. And he came to my parents' home and asked their permission, and they didn't know what to say. So off I went, initially to Hawaii, where he was stationed, and I spent 2 years in Hawaii, going to school at the school called Punahou, which happens to be where President Obama
went, right?
Went, yes. And I graduated there in 1948 and came to New York and entered Columbia College.
During the war, you had a German refugee living with you, a German Jewish refugee who was a nephew of Thomas Mann, the great author.
Yes, Klaus Bringsheim.
Yeah, it's a great story.
He was a character. Eventually, he came to America and served in the American Armed Forces and then moved to Canada. But anyway.
Well, you talk about a time during the bombing when he went outside and called out for the Americans to keep bombing. Tell us that. That must have flipped you guys out.
It certainly didn't. My father was very irate with him, and eventually he calmed down. And we didn't encounter any trouble because of him, but it was a real phenomenon.
How many Jewish refugees did you know during the war? Were there a fair number in Japan?
Yes, there was. Some were from Russia, some were from Germany, and in fact, there was that famous Japanese consul in Lithuania named Sugihara that you may have known about.
Yes, of course.
Who granted visas to Jews. He's honored in Japan.
And Yad Vashem as one of the righteous Gentiles in a prominent display there. That's right.
And we got to I got to know his widow, but my father, who spoke English, then used to accompany the German refugees to the American consul. This was before Pearl Harbor, when they were coming through, applying for American visas. A large quantity of them. And they couldn't speak English, and my father would serve as an interpreter, take them to the consulate, and help them process their visa applications. And there were quite a large quantity of them, but they didn't stay. The Jewish refugees who stayed during the war had come there earlier from a variety of places, Germany particularly, whereas these ones that Sugihara gave visas to came from Eastern Europe, mainly Russia, Poland, Lithuania, and so on. We knew a number of Jewish refugees, and we were friendly with the children our age who had come before Pearl Harbor and before the wave from Russia. And they lived in the neighborhood, they would go to the same schools. There were quite a number of them.
You know, the Jews who were in Shanghai, the famous Shanghai ghetto, experienced, after the Japanese takeover, some significant repression. That doesn't seem to have been the case with you or the people that you knew in Japan during the war.
No, but they were in an area occupied by the Japanese military.
Right.
And it was quite a different experience to live within the occupation area in China and Manchuria, or to live in Japan in a civilian community where the government was a civilian government, not a military government, and not all that close to the Germans. The Axis really was formed by the military, and so it was the Japanese military in China that worked with the Germans and may have been persecuting the Jews in Shanghai. But we didn't experience that at all in Japan.
It's an extraordinary story. When you went back to Japan, and you did a couple of times, lived there again later as a professional when you were a lawyer, what was the experience like going back?
It was very pleasant. I had my wife with me and our two daughters. We stayed there for 2 years. Our two daughters went to an international school called Sacred Heart, Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
They wore uniforms and were very well treated and had a very nice experience. Learned a little Japanese, which they promptly forgot. We lived in a very pleasant atmosphere. I worked a lot with Japanese clients. This was in the mid-70s, and it was quite different, obviously, from the wartime experience. Tokyo had been rebuilt with a lot of new build. We lived in a very new apartment house, which hadn't existed before, and it was an entirely different experience from the one I had living as a child.
The book is called Edoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan, by Isaac Shapiro. Really a remarkable, interesting, and very different story.
And it's available on Amazon.
As everything in the world seems to be these days.
Yeah. And they have a Kindle edition, and I did an audio book. I read the book for about 15 hours. And they can, if they don't want to buy the book, they can buy the audio book or the Kindle.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
It's a pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be award-winning Jewish writer Tova Mervis, author of The Book of Separation. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is another from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music. It's from the movie The Prince of Egypt. Jewish film composer extraordinaire Hans Zimmer wrote the score for the animated version of the Exodus, a celebration of miracles. Pesach is now less than 3 weeks away. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.